meant to do that. Now, actually, I didn't mean to do that. I just cut off Robert's outro. I am sorry. I didn't mean to do that. It was the wrong player at... Well, that's what they say. No, you can leave that open. Yeah, that's what the Mets always say. It was the wrong player. This is WBAI in New York City. Listeners sponsored, non-commercial, fully professional Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And, well, let's howl. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Okay, altered fluid is here. Now, to longtime listeners of Hour of the Wolf, you know what that means. To newbies, well, it's a treat. Stay tuned. Okay, this is going to be a very, very tight show, as it were, in terms of material, because we have easily 3 hours of material, but we're going to take 3 hours, not this week, but thanks to Robert Knight, next week. And I will explain why we're doing that next week in but a moment. But it is time indeed for announcements. So announcement number one. Well, announcement, you know, twice a month, RO is readings. And since Matt Kressel is here, well, I will tell you, it's the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading series, and it's a treat. It's a lot of people named Kelly. And you can link to one of that. Kelly Link, the last time she was here she was about 7 months pregnant and had a really bad cold. So that was like, what, 2.5 years ago? How old is the offspring, the Gavin and Kelly spawn?
Is a few years now.
A few years.
Yeah.
She's driving
now. Yeah. Yeah, right.
She pilots.
So that's planes. So Kelly was sick as anything at the time, and yet what a trooper. She drove down from Northampton and read anyway with a voice that was going. She's great. She is great. And she's a brilliant writer. So that's, you know, enough reason to show up at KGB. Ah, but wait, if you order right now, you can also get James Patrick Kelly. That's why we're talking about all these Kellys. Jim Kelly is, Think Like a Dinosaur is a story that will be read and talked about in 50 years. It's just a great story. He may do other things. And find things. They may eventually get around to making movies of his stuff or not. He's done a few radio dramas, but, well, he's a great reader and a wonderful storyteller. So that's Wednesday at, if you show up when it starts at 7 o'clock, you're not getting in.
No, don't show up at 7.
Yeah, a.m. maybe.
Well, they don't usually let you in until about 6:30.
Me in at 6:15. He wouldn't let Ellen in. He let me in and locked Ellen out. That was like, bizarre.
Was this Dan?
Of course it's Dan.
Dan, yeah. Well, Dan is a great guy.
Dan is a wonderful guy.
That's why he let you in.
Well, I tip him well, and you guys get your drinks for free.
But we expect next Wednesday to be a...
It should be crowded.
A crowded night.
So it should be a crowded night.
If you are
night.
Planning to come, I would get there early.
Well,
don't expect to sit.
There is
probably
a,
be standing.
I expect to sit because I'm recording the damn thing as always.
You have
I have my
privileges.
Seat. Yes, I have. Yes, I have, and I use them. But then later on that night, I did say next week was a 3-hour show.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know exactly when Hour of the Wolf began with Margot Adler, but we know that it was January 1972. We don't know the date, but we do know that it was approximately January 1972. Now, as I've said on the air, I don't really consider the show Hour of the Wolf. Hour of the Wolf was canceled about 14 months ago, and then I was off the air for about a month, and then the program director ecked out this time slot for me by taking half an hour away from Robert Knight and I think canceling somebody else altogether and worked me in here. But it's not the Hour of the Wolf. That's a whole other explanation, and we'll get to that next week. I won't host. Margot will host. Margot Adler, who created the show in 1972, will be the host next week. I'll engineer her, as I always did, but, you know, as I always did, my mouth will not be shut either. So this is sort of like a follow-up to the last ever Hour of the Wolf, which was a rather tearful occasion that we did in October of 2010. And then... As I say, this is a very different show. I haven't quite worked out exactly what it is or isn't, and I don't know, you know, we will have a new program director theoretically coming in somewhere in the next 2 months. Who knows? But in the meantime, it's 40 years since Hour of the Wolf went on the air, and so we're going to celebrate that next week from midnight to 3, and we want to thank Robert Knight for donating the 90 minutes of his show. Otherwise, it actually would have been this show, because when we have altered fluid on, we need more and more airtime. So instead, I simply eliminated what we recorded to begin with. Let me explain, or somebody else can help explain. Altered Fluid is a writer's group. There are about, what, three major writer's groups, science fiction writer's groups in New York?
I suspect it.
There's Tabula Rasa.
Quite a bit more than that, but...
Really? There's Hair in the Circle.
You're talking about science fiction and fantasy groups that we're aware of.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's
I have no idea the number, but I would suspect that it's more than three.
Really?
Yeah.
I know there's one in Long Island.
Right.
The only ones I've ever heard of are Circle in the Hair, the one that Linda Addison is in, and then Tabula Rasa and Altered Fluid, and name another.
This is Secret Cabal.
Yes, who
which
was
is Nora yeah. and myself came out of, actually, and Tom Crossell as well. So, and they're still meeting, actually. So.
Are they?
Yeah.
Uncle Black
get closer to the mic, Raj.
No, there are definitely a few others out there. I don't know if they come on the radio so often, but yeah, they're...
yeah, but they also don't...
They might be more secretive.
Yeah.
Yeah. That might...
They have
secret
handshakes and winks and...
Yeah, they stab with pens and stuff like that. A writer's group is a... well, it depends on the individual ones. It's both a support group and a critique group. Somebody submits either a story or a segment of a novel. Some groups don't allow novels. Others do. You know, fragments. Madeline Robbins had her story... had her first novel critiqued on a chapter-by-chapter basis. And the other members of the group, all of whom are writers, share their thoughts, hopefully positive thoughts, hopefully, you know, even if they're critical, even if it's, I didn't care for this, I didn't care for that.
Well, the idea is that we want to have constructive criticism. We're not there to bruise people's egos. We're there to improve the work, the story, the novella, the novel. We're there to make sure that we say, okay, you know, here's what's working, here's what's not working, and here's what we feel needs improvement. And then the author then goes back and works on it and makes a better piece of art. That's what we're here to do. We're not here to tear people's egos down or make them feel miserable and go home and cry.
Well, I mean, speak for yourself. This is WBAI.
If you want me to make you cry, I can. I mean, but I won't do that tonight.
That's just our relationship to our phone callers.
Right. So we've Altered Fluid has been meeting for about 10 years, I think it has been. Has it been that long?
It was March of 2001 was when we started Terry Bisson's class.
Been 11
so
years?
You're reaching 11 years in a couple of months.
A decade party.
It's been more. It's almost,
it was actually
yeah.
summer of 2001 that the writing group
more
started.
Than 10 years.
So,
yeah. So Terry Bisson, the group formed in the wake of Terry Bisson's class. And you know, Terry Bisson was also one of the founders of KGB, so there's... a nice connection here with the group.
Yeah. So, I miss Terry, but he's coming back, I hear.
March.
He's visiting. I have to get him on the show. I have to get him on the show. That's like...
Yeah.
Okay. So, so what? Okay. So the idea of what we have with the writers group is there are, what, about 13 people currently in Altered Fluid, all told, including satellite members?
Exactly. Yeah, including satellite members. I think we have approximately 10 or 11 members who are local to New York, the New York City area, and then we have two
We're
possibly...
worldwide with the satellite members.
That's true. We have a member in Latvia, we have a member in Hawaii.
A member in Philly.
A member in Philadelphia, which is not as far, and
yeah.
nor
but
as
those,
exotic.
Those are your primary three satellite members.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And
Chicago. Detroit. Detroit.
Okay, so Saladin is still a member?
Yes.
We haven't drummed him out yet.
Yeah,
because he didn't do a crit for...
Well, let's get him on the phone.
He has
I'm willing. He's got twins. He'll be awake at this hour.
Twins and overlords.
Right.
His novel's coming out soon.
And it's an hour earlier over
in March,
isn't it?
In March. I
in March, is it?
Yes.
His novel's coming out earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've got, you know, all these people coming out with novels in March, including E.C. Myers and...
E.C. Myers, Saladin. Fair Coin, pre-order it now. Saladin, Ahmed.
I have my copy. It's an arc.
Throne of the Crescent Moon, order mm-hmm. it now.
Yeah. Sorry?
No, I know we have a limited time on the show.
Right, okay, so we need to... So here's the deal. A writer reads a story. This is about the eighth time we're doing this, seventh or eighth time we're doing
this. At least.
Yeah. A writer reads a story on the air, and then everybody critiques it. Now, this time we pre-recorded the critiques, and it's now 3 months later. So we actually have something we've never had before, a revision to the story based on the crits. Now, we don't have time. The critiques were... well over an hour long, actually 50 minutes long, and then the discussion with Devin, who wrote the story, Devin Poor, afterward. And so what we have done is we have cut down the critiques to 15 minutes, giving everybody a little bit of chance to say something. But if you want to hear the whole thing, and we know you do, what you do is you go to ourwolf.com/AF, as an altered fluid. And in fact, if you go there now, you can see photographs of the people during the thing. And then after this show, after you hear the story, you can listen to the entire hour plus of the crits. But on the program, we're going to do 15 minutes instead of the pre-recorded crits, and then we'll talk. So our reader this morning is Devin Poor. And each time we've had a different person. So far, so we're coming full circle on the group at a certain point. Mm-hmm. We'll have to figure out how to do Saladin.
We have some new members too. So
do you? Okay,
mm-hmm. We'll talk about that another time.
We'll talk about that. Yeah. So Devin,
yes.
First, tell us who you are. Your bio.
As you said, I am Devin Poor, and I am the reader tonight. Matt and I joined Altered Fluid in 2003?
Sounds right.
Sounds about right. One of those years.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
Actually, besides the founding members, we're the oldest still standing in the group. And I write short stories, obviously, novels. I have two novels completed, one that I'm going through revisions on now, and I generally write not so much science fiction, but more like urban fantasy and what you could maybe call like historical fantasy or historical speculative fiction, things like that. And this this story tonight definitely falls in that realm.
Alrighty. So now we should point out what you are reading is the first draft.
Yes, this is definitely the first draft, and whenever we play the critiques later, those are going to be all based upon what I am reading. And since as you said, this was 3 months ago, I have worked on this since then. I have not completed the revisions completely, but I've definitely made some changes, which we can talk about.
Okay.
And a lot of those were brought about by directly from the comments that we will hear in the critiques.
So why don't we get to the story itself?
Okay.
And, my mic is so loud. When I lower my microphone, all of a sudden, the broadcast air is so much better in so many ways. But
all right. This is titled number 35, which is going in with the era of edits and critiques. That is a tentative title. And so we begin. For he is the resurrection and the light, the priest shouted to someone in the sky, which as far as I was concerned meant no one. He needed to be focused on that which was on his same plane at the moment, not shrieking at someone who wasn't listening. I pushed my hat forward to shield my eyes from the glare of the sun off the creek, as if the noonday light had some sway over my ears, and I listened, hard, not to the priest, but for what I knew had to be out there watching us. And I doubted that they were afraid of a cross or the man bearing it. How's this supposed to do us any good? I whispered to Miss Summers, who squatted a few feet to my right in the scrub and sand. She shook her head and raised her finger to her lips. Shh. Our Father, that are in heaven, the priest continued. I looked at Miss Summers. I don't recall that one going that way, I said. I ask you to reconsider, Bob, I yelled at the priest. He stood up to his ankles in running water that stained the bottom of his dark robe with sand up to near his knees, a wooden cross, nearly the size of him, hoisted on a pole above his head. I pictured the thing we'd seen the night before as we rode into town, how it hadn't cared about the torches, how hard it had died. If they ain't afraid of fire, they ain't afraid of your dress and stage props. He ignored me. Miss Summers still had her finger at her lips, staring out at Father Bob and the stunted trees and boulders just past him. I pulled one of my scuffed revolvers out and slowly turned over the chambers, the metallic click that revealed each round firmly seated the closest thing that I needed to a prayer. I returned the piece and without looking at Miss Summers and said, "Yeah, I know. Shh." The movement in the bush and the brush 20 yards beyond was sudden and upon Father Bob before he knew what was happening. Fortunately for him, I figured it out a breath sooner. Human. They all look so damn human, especially at a distance. Except for the speed. This one covered the 20 yards in the amount of time it took me to draw and fire. Not fully upright, I took my first shot while still in a crouch. I continued to stand and fire, fanning the hammer of the gun with the palm of my right hand, and I could tell you damn near every shot hit that thing. It collapsed in a heap right in the water in front of Father Bob and writhed in the muddy and bloody water. Bob backpedaled, fell to his ass, and dropped his stage prop symbol to the crucifixion. I headed towards him at a run. Father Bob struggled up and spluttered water and sand from his mouth, eyes wide as the desert moon. The water wasn't even deep enough to wash down into my boots, but it worked on the sand enough to make standing a conscious endeavor. "Stay down, Bob," I ordered, and reached over to push him in the middle of the chest, sending his plump ass back into the drink. The creature's body lay flat and splayed, face down, like it had fallen from a great height into a post-battle likeness, but this one in color as blood set from it in pink rivulets. I wedged a boot under it and flipped it to its back. Pale skin and scarred hands from working the mines, the gaunt body, and the teeth. They jutted this way and that, easily seen as the lips had been pretty much chewed away as well, leaving a black maw of what looked for all the world like a fistful of broken pottery shards. My six shots had taken it square in the chest, so close I noticed with satisfaction that you could barely tell where any individual bullet had hit. "Are there any more around?" Father Bob asked, now at my elbow, his voice cracking. "They'd have been on us already." I kicked at the shoulder of the thing. It bobbed momentarily and then began to float away, pink streamers of diluted blood preceding it as it followed after the crucifix now well downstream. I figured Father Bob would object, say something about the beast having once been a man, but he saw those teeth again, looked away, and smoothed his robes, smearing more of the sand. "Let's get out of here," he said. I fed bullets into the revolver's chamber, and I realized that one of our party was missing, about 50 yards away. Miss Summers walked slowly, eyes fixed on the wet ground before her, backtracking along the footprints of the thing I'd just killed. "Should have gone to California," I said, finished loading my gun, and followed her. I walked into the bar, still wiping the sand from my trousers and spitting it from my mouth. I dropped to a stool, shook off an offer of whiskey from the bartender, and nodded towards the water. Miss Summers came in. "Maybe we should try to catch one," she said. "You know, to study it." "Catch one?" I said. I'd been lucky to kill that thing. I remembered the other one, outside of town when we'd arrived, and the blur of its movement made me shudder. "We need more distance between us so we can kill them, not less so that we can catch them. They're fast." "I know they're fast." "I'm not sure their speed made the same impression on you as it did on me," I said and glanced over at her. It took some getting used to, seeing a woman in trousers and a working shirt, her hair long and black, braided back, and sometimes when she moved her head it swished like she was swatting at flies. Kind of reminded me of Constance Morton, my sister-in-law back home, even though I hadn't seen her in years. "Meaner than a two-headed snake, too," I returned to the subject at hand. "We, you, will not be catching one." She shook her head as if to clear it of thoughts, and her hair did the horsetail thing again. Yeah, she definitely favored my brother's widow. "What of Father Bob?" I asked as she sat heavy next to me. "He want to catch one, too?" She took the whiskey still on the bar and downed it in a single gulp. She shuddered as if chilled and coughed once, demurely. I smiled. Father Bob thought they might be like the vampires of Europe, immobilized by the power of the cross. She spoke to me, but her eyes suddenly were fixed over my shoulder. I turned to see a slight man in a bowler hat along the far wall. They seemed more perturbed of it, and determined to end both it and him, I said. There has to be some way to get at them, she said, as if far away, and stood slowly. I don't see what, I began. She stood and without a word walked towards the man in the bowler hat, someone she knew, I assumed. Mr. Morton? I jumped at the voice behind me and turned to find a woman approaching, the front door still swinging at her entrance. She clasped her hands around a small coin purse as if offering them to Father Bob's God. Ma'am, I said, and stood, headed for the door. If you would, she said, and put her hand to stop me. I'd like to hire you. To kill my husband, Sebastian, she said. Then her voice cut. To end his misery. I held up my hand to silence her. I didn't want to know any names. I took a single coin from the purse, tossed it onto the bar, and handed it back to her. He was a miner, I asked. She nodded. I imagine I'll get to him eventually, I said, and remembered the thing I'd shot out in the creek, the one the night before, if I haven't already. My pa had always told me to stay away from women who wanted something from you. They all want something, mind you, he told me, but the ones you want are the ones or them that won't come looking for it. The ones that'll sit and wait all quiet for you to come to them. You don't want those presumptuous ones. I'd met Miss Summers for the first time in the cattle trail in Wichita. Wood floors were stained with what you hoped is only spilled whiskey, smoke in the air, a rickety bar. You know the type of place. Nice to meet you, Nathan Morton, she'd said, extending her hand. I'm sure my eyebrow must have twitched at her knowing my name because she smiled wide. I know a few things about you, like how you almost served during the War of the Rebellion, but even with skipping that adventure, you're still a good hand with a gun. Sorry about your brothers. A man don't need a war to learn how to shoot. Hell, that standing in line and doing what you're told is more likely to get a man killed than to teach him anything. Just ask my brothers, Walt and Vance, if they'd survived Antietam, that is. I didn't tell her any of that, though. Just said, your telegraph said something about a job. Straight to the point, she said. I like that quality. What I need is protection. We sat at a table. She ordered a whiskey and me a water. We talked about men acting as monsters, terrified townsfolk, and gold. She saw me start at the mention of the gold and then continued talking about what she needed, as if I'd already said yes. Guess I always liked my women a little presumptuous. I looked in on the horses, past Father Bob in the street on my way back to the hotel. He spoke with a few of the women folk who had the look of those who'd lost their husbands. Not crying or such, but when you sit out of war, you see a lot of women left behind and suddenly alone. And you get to recognize the look when they realize the absence is permanent. They spoke to him quietly in either English or Spanish, beseeching, lost. I caught Father Bob's eye, and he had a momentarily startled look, like a deer that knows the bullet's coming. But then he saw me and went all serene. Upstairs at the hotel, I pushed open the door to my room, paused, turned, and pounded on Miss Summers' door across the hall. The door opened and she stood there in bare feet, blouse untucked and hair disheveled, pressing a wet wash rag to the back of her neck. Father Bob isn't having any effect on these things, I said. I've got enough on my plate to keep you and me from getting shredded out there. You should cut him loose. She scrunched up her eyes and thought. What makes you think I can just cut him loose, she asked. Do you assume that I'm paying him too? That a man of God will sell his services? Some men, Mr. Morton, give themselves freely. Not like some who only surrender what is brought. She paused, and sometimes not even that. I felt myself flush for the first time in my recollection. It had been my friend Jeremy Boughton's idea that we enlist in the Union Army, and then we'd got the bounty money, desert, and go to another county and do it again. We'd been kids. At least that was how I'd rationalize why I hadn't had the courage to either do it again or go off to war. Easier to run west, out of the States, leaving everything behind. At least it had seemed easier then. So if I'm for hire, then where's the first coin of my employment, I asked. I stepped in closer. Her breath was warm and had the tinge of alcohol. I've had strangers in the bar offer me more restitution than you and your supposed contract. She spun on her heel and sand trickled out of the cuff of her trousers. She tossed the cloth back on the desk, just a little too carefully, so that it covered a book. You will be paid in full by the mining company. That's the deal. You know that. Then what is our next move about finding the source of what turned these men into these things? I'll handle that. I'm the geologist, she said. You're not actually a geologist. My father taught me everything he knew, she said, and now her face flushed. I worked with him. I raised my hand. Relation or proximity doesn't affect one's knowledge. I've ridden on wagon trains before. That doesn't make me a pack mule. Her eyes bored into me, her lips pursed, skin flushed. Did a good job of making you an ass. We're getting nowhere with this, I interrupted. Agreed. And since she got a gleam in her eye that I didn't like. So, I asked. We go into the mine, she said. I swallowed hard. I'd never been a religious man, but suddenly I didn't have a desire to send Father Bob away. I awoke in my room to the glow of the moon at the window and voices in the hall. I trust you, not him, Father Bob said in hushed tones. Shut up and get in here, Miss Summers said. I went back to sleep and dreamt of the three men I'd killed outside St. Louis. Lawmen, the papers said. They hadn't specified their vocation, though, when they'd ridden me off the road and put guns to my head. I started awake again to silence and lay there thinking of bounty hunters and long lists of the dead hanging outside the post office back home. Miss Summers and I went back and forth about whether or not to leave Father Bob behind. She would have none of it, nor would he. Did not the armies of the Union go into battle, each unit with a man of God at their side, he said. That's what I hear, I said as I shoved my belongings into my saddlebag. I pushed him into the still dim hall of the hotel, the sun creeping up the window at the eastern end. Miss Summers stood in the doorway, half in shadow, a long black bag at her feet. You might want to tell him of how effective those men of God were at keeping the casualties down, I said. I was down the stairs before she could open her mouth. The sun cleared the top of the buildings as we left town. It arched over us and the desert and then the low canyon and then the foot of the mountains, and by the time we reached the mine, it sat in the west as if it's perched on the top of the hill that held the cave we sought. All about lay the implements of man. A water tower to the left, a ramshackle wooden structure built over the entrance, door askew, and two narrow iron rails running in through that broken door. A hitching post stood near the structure, but I was having none of that. We backtracked down the path we had come, and just past a jumble of natural boulders and silt deposited by man, we hobbled the horses and I set off towards the mine. "What's the plan?" Miss Summers asked. Father Bob pulled out his book and began to pray. "See if we can get them out into the open," I said, and headed for the old hitching post. Dry rot had set in as I'd hoped, and a few kicks knocked it to the ground. We set to breaking it to pieces, and after shaving off some slivers with my knife to start the fire, a roaring blaze soon snapped and cracked, yellow light flickering in Miss Summers' eyes. "How do you know this'll work?" "I spent many nights sleeping in the cold and dark," I said, "because if you leave a fire lit at night, something's going to show up, usually something with a mean streak." I moved around the fire, put a hand on her shoulder. She had that book from her hotel room out, and the long bag of her work implements at her feet. I said, "Stay here," and approached the door to the mine. The door hung at an odd angle, only the top hinge keeping it attached. It creaked once on a soft breath of cold air from within. Smell of damp earth, water, a grave. I could hear nothing. "They might not come out until full dark," I said as a way of getting some sound out into the world, even though I knew there was no truth to it. I wanted that door gone, so I could get a better look at the tunnel. I grabbed hold of the door, pulled. A slight splintering sound, but then I froze. A cold hand upon mine. Miss Summer screamed. Another hand appeared, and a creature forced its face into the gap at the door like some grotesque birth. Wide mouth of jumbled teeth, lips and teeth torn away, even the eyelids shredded as if the eyes were trying to escape its skull. Stepped backwards as I pulled the revolver, and I swear the thing's eyes went wide at the speed of it. I fired three times with the muzzle pressed to its head, and as the report echoed down the entryway, the thing fell dead, its hair smoldering from burning powder. And then another one at the doorway. A sharp crack and it fell too, but I hadn't fired. I scrambled to my feet and back to the far side of the fire where Miss Summers stood with her legs splayed wide and a pistol gripped in both hands, slowly taking shots. I moved off to the side, out of the flame's glare, focused on the dark rectangle of the doorway. I didn't know geologists' daughters knew how to shoot, I said, and kicked the now empty bag at her feet. Stop with the talk and keep count, she said. I grunted assent, and they came out into the glare. Miss Summers and I continued our methodical execution of the miners, as Father Bob's voice rose in prayer above it all. Father Bob came into the clearing and the light of the fire with an armload of wood. I found Miss Summers near the mine entry, casually counting aloud, the book in her hand, her thumb inserted to hold her place. 27, she said to me as I approached. She flipped open the book, ran her finger down the page, turning it up to the side to catch more light from the flames. Plus the one in the town our first night and the one at the creek. That's 30, see? She ran her finger down the list. Sanchez, Harris, Lincoln. I closed the book and handed it to her. No names. The bodies lay strewn about in contorted shapes. I wondered if one of them was Sebastian. There was already starting a smell. Coppery blood, bile, excrement. 30. Great, I said. I learned my numbers a few years back. No need for a refresher exercise. The fire flared as Father Bob dumped the wood upon it, sparks spiraling upward. This is the mine's ledger, she said and foisted the book at me. They employed 35 in the shaft. 3 left, I said. Mr. Boiler Hat gave you through this? I asked, remembering the man at the bar. Gave? Sure, she shrugged. She walked to the fire and tossed the book in. About that, I said and nodded at the rifle. Why hire me if you can shoot? There's a lot of them, she said, her face set in a what are you stupid expression. I'm good, but not that good. Let's get into the mine. What, now? Father Bob asked. At night? Bob, I said, it doesn't get any lighter underground after the sun rises. I put out my hand and stopped her as she walked past. Need to collect your gear, Professor Geologist, to do some tests inside the mine? Later. This time's just a reconnaissance mission. Reconnaissance, right, I said under my breath. Miss Summers insisted on leading the way. Father Bob brought up the rear, far in the rear. His torch shook visibly in his hand. Second thoughts about bringing God into the mine, I called over my shoulder. No response. I returned to see him shaking his head, eyes wide, mouth evidently unable to move for the first time since I'd met him. Should have brought him down here sooner. My feet fell into the rhythm of the path between the rail car tracks. And then I realized I couldn't see Miss Summers' torch anymore. Miss Summers, I called. Then I yelled her name again. My God. From further down the shaft. A gunshot tore through the air, dropped dust and gravel from the ceiling. Pressing on, I saw a glow ahead, her torch just to the right around a bend where the car tracks split. I rounded the corner, torch in one hand, pistol in another. And there she stood, a smile on her face, looking down into a rail car. Gun smoke clung to the ceiling, a creature set back to a board retaining wall, a red streak of gore from where it slid to the ground. I'd hoped for a blur behind her, and I drew and shot. The creature fell forward, dead, its head thudding on the rail car. Miss Summers looked at it dismissively, then continued. I'd hoped, but hadn't counted on, this bit of luck, she said and motioned me to come closer. Large leather satchels, cinched tight at the top. She reached in and pulled one open. Inside lay raw gold, pieces as big as an apple and smaller, some with rocks jutting from it, some as pure and clean as a $20 piece. Father Bob came up from behind me and whistled low. Just as you said, he whispered, and looked at Miss Summers. So we go on now and find the other miners. What, 'cause they're in a situation, I asked, and I smiled, because I knew the answer. As an employee of the mine, you surely must. Knock it off, she said, and I felt Father Bob's hands go to my holsters. I reached back and knocked one hand away, but not before Miss Summers had her rifle on me. She was so close that I swear I could see the tip of the bullet down the barrel. Mr. Boilerhat had at the bar, I said. He's the real employee sent to investigate, right? Father Bob took my guns and moved to her side. She nodded. Your father, I asked. Shoemaker back in Cleveland, she said. With a slight flick of her wrist, she pulled the trigger. The gun fired and my face filled with smoke and burning embers of powder, and I heard the bullet rip past my left ear as clearly as if it was the size of a southbound freight. I staggered forward as the lifeless body of the creature that came up behind me fell into me. "Are you?" she asked and stepped towards me. Father Bob put his hand on her shoulder and stopped, and she stopped. "What's my real role here?" I said. "Your role," Father Bob said, raising his voice so we could hear over the ringing in our ears, "is to be suspect. Mr. Boiler Hat, as you called him, will wake up with a raging hangover sometime in the next 6 hours. Find his ledger book and other pertinent mine papers missing." He turned to Miss Summers. "Correct?" She nodded. "They know you've been in town asking about the mine. He'll probably show up here tomorrow, with an armed guard, of course." He came around me and pulled my arms down, tied them behind me, and pushed me up against the wall. Miss Summers bit her lower lip. "Not very Christian, Father Bob," I said. "My damn name's Henry," he said, and clubbed me over the head. I awoke to the sight of Father Bob's back as he pushed at the cart with the strength of a horse. It moved slowly, out of the chamber and towards the entrance. "I have a soft spot for you, Nathan," Miss Summers said, nearly whispered, as she tied my feet together. "Almost ashamed to leave you here. You were useful. Miss Summers." I said, "Call me Carrie," she interrupted, leaned in, and kissed me lightly on the lips. I sat there in the dark for minutes, hours, who knows how long. I ran the numbers in my head and kept coming up with a sum I didn't much like. 2 dead in here with me, 1 in the creek, 1 outside of town, 30 laying outside the mine, 1 missing. The one missing's the one that bothered me. I struggled with my wrists. The rope wouldn't budge. I shifted my feet. The rope there did move, just a bit. "Why, Miss Summers," I said, and started moving my boots. It was so dark I couldn't even see them. But then a noise, footsteps, from deeper in the mine, up the tracks, into the room. Just the crunching of steps, and then they stopped, right in front of me. Sweat ran into my eyes. My heart thudded. I could hear it breathing. "Get it over with," I shouted. The feet shuffled, stumbled, and someone cursed. "You're alive?" a voice asked. A spark, brighter than the sun, and a torch flared to life. "I heard gunshots," the man said. "Saw lights earlier. I've been hiding here for so long I've been hiding here for I don't know how long. Are they gone, the monsters?" And I looked up into the face of number 35. The 1247 train only slowed at the station, not a full stop. I stepped aboard. I spent my last gold piece on one of the lumps of the stone-speckled gold I'd scavenged from the floor of the mine on getting the information on who was on the train and in which car. It'd taken me a month and thousands of miles of searching and chasing. Third card back, one of the fancy ones. I stopped at the first door and listened to the woman speaking within. "We can definitely find the source of your issue, Mr. Jennings. An oil man such as yourself need not be concerned with." I pushed the door open and pulled my revolver. Miss Summers, Carrie, sat on the far side of the room. The man she spoke to, his back to me, looked over his shoulder, eyes wide. Father Bob, or Henry, sat along the wall in a three-piece suit, spectacles, and a full beard, in mid-bite of a sandwich. Carrie smiled at me, first a smirk, and then it went wide. She was in a dress, a strange sight for her, her hair crammed up under a lace-covered hat, and I had her right hand under the purse on her lap. I heard the click of a cylinder turning over. "I do apologize," she said to the man in the suit. "Mr. Smith here," she nodded at me. "It's my hired security hand. He gets a bit anxious at times when I don't check in." She motioned me in, and I put away the pistol, hand still on it, and I sat. "Mr. Jennings was just telling me and Mr. Ashen," she nodded at Father Bob, "of his security needs for his new oil business." I smiled at Bob, Carrie, and then Mr. Jennings. "I think we can help him with that," I said. And that was it.
And you've been listening to number 35, First Draft, read for you by the author Devin Poor. This is WBAI in New York City, Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me in studio are five members of Altered Fluid Writers Group. And assuming that this were an actual meeting, which is what we've done several times on the show before, at least simulated meetings, what would now happen is that each member of the group in turn would have a certain amount of time. Now, we're about to hear what occurred at such a meeting. David Mercurio Rivera is going to explain it all for you, but he's going to explain what took place over an hour. And what you are going to hear is, in fact, 15 minutes long. Fear not. We have the whole thing for you on our DVD extra, or actually our web extra. After this broadcast, what you can do, having heard the story, if you want to hear all of the crits, there's a jargon within altered fluid. I don't know. I haven't heard other people use the word crit. It makes all the sense in the world. But it's short for, I assume it's critique as opposed to criticism.
Yeah.
It's a critique. Yeah, and it's a critter critique, depending on, you know, if I do it, it's a critter critique. So what we're hearing is an extremely edited version. We're going to hear from each person in turn, but instead of the 3 minutes or so that David mentions, it's going to be about 1 minute. But he'll explain the ditto and the anti-ditto and... Mm-hmm.
Does he explain in there that basically the phraseology like crit and ditto and anti-ditto and the format we use comes from the Clarion and Clarion West workshops?
No, didn't mention that.
Okay, that's where basically all of this, the format comes from.
Clarion West is how I got this radio show.
Mm.
Well, we'll talk about that next week. But Margot Adler left Hour of the Wolf for 6 weeks to go to Clarion West. Mm. I took over. So she has her, what do they call that? The All Things Considered? That her show. And I've got Hour of the Wolf, you know, and so there. But Margot will be doing Hour of the Wolf next week. Anyway, I can't get over that enough. Whenever Margot's around, I cavil, you know. That's the crit word. So we are now going to hear David Mercurio Rivera explain it all for you. But as I said, after the broadcast, what you do is you go to ourwolf.com. That's HOURWOLF, as in Hour of the Wolf, .com/AF, as in altered fluid. There isn't a link to it, so you have to know that whole thing. ourwolf.com/AF. And oh, yes, by the way, you can see photographs. Sort of. They're little camera photographs that I took of everybody at the time that they were doing the crits. So we're going to hear the people there and then cut in. In turn, we're going to hear the three satellite members who were not present at the time. They couldn't hear what the other people said. Sometimes somebody will mitigate a little bit of what they were going to say because somebody else has already said it and they've already dittoed it, so they don't have to go through that and they can talk about something else instead. The satellite members did not have that privilege. Mm-hmm. Okay, so those are the differences, and now we are going to hear the what will we call it? The abbreviated critiques of altered fluid for the first draft of the story, number 35 by Devin Poor.
Take it away, David.
Welcome, everybody. This is a meeting of Altered Fluid. And we're here tonight to critique a story, read a story, and critique a story by Devin Poor. And I guess I'll give you a little bit of background about how the critique process works. All of us here have read Devin's story before tonight. And what we're going to go around the table and take turns speaking, giving our thoughts and suggestions. And we'll typically be talking about three things: what works in the story, what doesn't work in the story, and then suggestions on ways to improve the story. Other critiquers may say only one word while anyone else is doing their crit, or two words, either ditto or anti-ditto, signaling that they agree with the point or disagree with the point being made. And after everyone has their turn, there's an open, free-willing discussion where everyone, including the author, may finally speak, and then all hell breaks loose.
And then
we dance. So that's the way the process works. Usually we start with the person sitting to the left of the writer, and that person is the famous...
Oh, don't start.
N.K. Jemisin, also known as Nora.
Thank you. Okay, number 35. I really, really like this. It reminded me a lot of some of Stephen King's Gunslinger stories, which I've been a huge raving, screaming fan of for years. And I was kind of expecting it to go in some directions that it ultimately did not go. So I think that's where I will start my critique. The first and foremost thing that kind of frustrated me about this story, because it came so close to being perfect for me, was you did not explain the monsters.
I
needed to know what caused 34 miners to turn into creepy creatures. I needed to know what caused number 35 not to transform. You named the story after number 35, and then he had utterly no importance whatsoever.
He's anti-ditto when you have...
Yes, I guess he doesn't agree.
This is Kay Tempest Bradford. Looking at this piece, I was basically trying to suss out what it's about. I mean, on like a different level other than like just what happens in the story. And while I found that I really enjoyed the voice, I really enjoyed just the tone that you were creating.
Yeah.
The world, there was such effortless world building that it just really, you know, engaged me and sucked me in. And I really found myself liking your narrator. But in the end, I couldn't figure out what this was about on a meta level, simply because I did not understand the choices that were being made at the very end of the story.
Hi, I'm Rajan Khanna. I like Westerns, you know, I like weird Westerns, so I was with you there. And I really like the creatures in this because they don't really fall into any particular like mold. You know, they seem a little zombie-ish, they seem a little vampire-ish, and I like the description of them without having a particular name put to them.
Yeah.
I also felt that I didn't really get a good sense of tension or threat level in the story. The opening scene is the only one where I thought that something bad could have happened. From that point, the tension drops out, and for example, when they go to the mines, they kill 27 of the creatures fairly easily in a short period of time. And I was just, you know, when I stopped to think about that, I thought, well, they're going to have to reload. There's no way they get that many bullets ready. And that's, I think, a key moment where you could ramp up the tension rather than letting it just kind of fizzle away like that. When I was reading through, I realized that the second scene, even though I like starting stuff in action, the second scene seemed to work much better for me at setting things up for the rest of the story, that I kind of was wondering if maybe you could bump that up to the beginning and then move that tension-filled scene a little bit later.
I'm Lila Wilde. As far as the creatures, they first appear as things, then like humans. Then we find out they formerly really were humans. I can't get a firm grip on how I'm supposed to see them on the way into the story. I'd like to see human faces ravaged by the change. We're just seeing the teeth, and it's very alien. I'd like to see the teeth in the whole face. I want to see the mining work close. I thought that the scarred hands were a really good detail. And I love the bit about how the eyes went wide at the sight of the gun, hinting towards a consciousness.
Yeah.
And I like the subtleties that Father Bob is not that great at his job. There's a double duty line on how he has nothing to say about the beast having once been a man, so now we know they were once human while also showing his priestly incompetence. But the part where he's comforting the widows is too obvious. I want to be more surprised he's a bad guy. And there's a line in here about how his mouth was unable to move for the first time since Nathan met him. This could be played up more and a good chance to throw some dark comedy into it. Mr. Bowler Hat needs to be more connected to the plot. Nathan suddenly remembering him at the end, and the guy didn't do anything but show up. He needs to do more.
I'm Aliyah Don Johnson. I felt one of the things I felt in the story was that there was a tonal shift kind of in the like the latter third, where it had started out very bleak and kind of spare, and in the latter third it started getting a little more madcap. By the end I felt like it was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and I mean nothing wrong, I love Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, but it was like, and even that movie has a tonal shift, but I feel like to balance those you need to have elements of the madcap in the beginning and elements of the bleak in the end, whereas right now it's they seem kind of strange.
Yeah.
And I thought one way that you could do that and solve a lot of issues is I really wanted more of Carrie in the story. I wanted more of their dialogue and banter. I felt like at the end there was something really cool about the relationship they had, but it was like such a bare hint. And I think there was some of that in the very beginning of the very beginning scene, and there's some of that in the very last scene, and there's very little in the middle.
I'm Chris Dykeman. Okay. Yes to all the good stuff, to the setting, to the way that they speak, to the in media res opening, which I liked very much. Yes to all the stuff that everybody liked, and no to some other stuff that I'm about to get to. I feel like I want more information about the minor ghoul vampire creatures and how they got it started. The mining company understand about the danger, is I guess what I wanted to know when they send them in. For a story, this is Dittoing Raj, for a story about scary creatures, not so scary. No one actually dies, for one thing. You've got the loaded ghoul on the fireplace, but you're don't really seem to be setting them off. You've got 35 of these things running, 34 of these things running around, and they don't sink their teeth into anybody, and that's not truth in advertising, my friend. I think the not reverend should, you should excuse the expression, get it in the neck, preferably right around the time about that line about his not being Henry. I think somebody thinks should come out and say, oh, you're lunch, you know, and just get it. If they're in that mine, and the mine is close to the town, what's happening to the town? I mean, what's happening to the local population? Dinner. I don't mean to be harsh. But Dirty Rotten Scoundrels called, and they want their ending back.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
I am David Mercurio Rivera. Okay, I'll start off by anti-dittoing Chris. I do think that the ending is terrific. I just love that switch at the end where it's revealed that they're all con artists and that the priest is not really a priest. I just, to me, that made the story. Given the fact that the priest is not really a priest, whether he would chance exposing himself to vampires wielding this crucifix when he's not really
Ditto.
A priest. I don't like the title. I agree with Nora that I don't think that the story is about number 35. If you rewrite it to change it the way Chris suggested, then it really does become about number 35. Mm-hmm. But if you want to keep him an ordinary human being who comes out at the end, then you have to change the title and make it something that's more evocative.
Hi, I'm Matt Kressel. I had a lot of questions. How did two or three zombie monsters, whatever you want to call them, escape the mine if this heavy door was closed? Why can the narrator open the door, but these really super fast and strong monsters can't open the door? How did miner number 35 survive without food and water for several days in a mine infested with the monsters? Like others have said, I think we need to see people killed. I need to see like blood and gore. I need to really feel that they're threatening, because right now they're not very threatening. Father Bob to me didn't quite work as a character. He's a thief. He's an imposter. But at every opportunity that he has to act, he acts like a priest. Except there's like two instances. One where he messed up the prayer, and another time where he didn't say a prayer over a dead body. But like other times he's like praying, he's like walking into the cave reading his prayer book, and I'm thinking, if he's an imposter, no, he'd be had his hand on his gun, he'd be doing something that a thief would be doing, not somebody that a priest would be doing. So and the last thing I will say is I'm not quite sure if their plan to pin the crime on him works logically. Because they're tying him up in the cave, and then they say, oh, well, he's the suspect. Well, how is he the suspect? Clearly, someone else took the gold and tied him up. So I didn't understand the logic at all.
I'm Rick Bowes. Definitely the Old West SF fantasy trope is hot. Hobson's novel Native Star is zombies, and the Old West cowboys and aliens was just that and nothing more. First drafts are kind of hard to critique since the author's full intent isn't manifested. There's a story here, but I think it needs a bit more definition. The opening seems to me more like a TV show or a movie opening, a long visual. The story needs more definition. If the narrator can shoot the way he apparently can, six hits on short notice at a rapidly moving target, I wonder if he's superhuman in some way, or if he should be waiting for Buffalo Bill to organize his Wild West show rather than risking his life going after vampire miners.
Hi, my name is Paul Berger. Ditto all the good stuff. I really had a lot of fun reading this. It was engaging and compelling, and I think you have the bones of a good story here. Tempest had mentioned that she didn't see what the story was really about. My take on this is that I think the story is actually about Morton's descent into cynicism and further amorality than he started the story with. That's his arc, just to get more cynical. One thing I'd like to see more in this story is some elaboration on what the bad guy's con really is. You make it clear that the monsters aren't afraid of sunlight, but for most of the story they seem like the type of creatures that would be. And it was interesting. I couldn't tell if you meant them to be zombies or vampires, and it seems to be split 50-50. Half of us refer to them as zombies and half as vampires. And I'm going to end it there. But I really enjoyed this, and I think there's a lot of potential here.
Hi, Devin. This is Tom Crosshill with greetings from Latvia. So this was a fun, immersive, intriguing sort of read. I really had a good time with it. I liked Nathan's character a lot with his deserter background and his liking for presumptuous women. And I thought the overall structure of the story worked pretty well with the scam and the final reversal that put Nathan in with the scammers. I think that's a good structure, and you've got the bones of a good story. I think basically what the story needs is more, and I mean more of everything. Basically, it needs to be fleshed out. We need to understand the scam better. I had a bit of a hard time understanding how they had planned it, what the whole idea was. Did they know these big lumps of gold would just be lying around there? Was that kind of the crux of the scam, and how would they apply this in different situations as at the end? And then the other thing was, this is a science fictional story, so I had a hard time understanding how the science fictional element tied into the scam. Ideally, it should be really integral to the story, and you know, also either toss out Father Bob or expand him significantly, I would say.
Aloha, this is Greer Woodward calling for the Altered Fluid meeting. Oh, it's always a treat to read specfic stories set in the past. Focusing on the last part of the story, I wasn't convinced that Nathan would want to join forces with Miss Summers and Father Bob. The pair had fooled Nathan and stolen the gold, but I think the story would benefit from a stronger and more personal previous incident to establish Nathan's change. There's a kiss in the mine, but I didn't think that was enough to build a future on. Turning to the story's beginning, I think the first few paragraphs are slow, especially for an action drama. Father Bob's opening line, "I am the resurrection and the light," is also a bit stale. Many stories could and probably have begun with that. If you began later with human, they all look so damn human, especially at a distance, you'd start with something that reflects the uniqueness of the story and leads two sentences later to gunfire. Which brings me to Father Bob. Of the three major characters, he seems the most dimensional. I'd like to see more cracks in his facade, like his slip with the prayer. I'll conclude with three sequences in the story I thought were particularly striking. I like Nathan's observations about the War of Rebellion, the description of war widows, and Nathan's conversation with Sebastian's wife and her sad, unexpected request.
Hi, Devin. Hi, everyone. This is Eugene. I think this is in pretty good shape. Overall, I really like the voice. I like the main character. I like the dialogue a lot. The period details, what details there are very good, and I would actually like a few more to kind of ground me right from the beginning, because it took me a while to figure out that this wasn't just some like secondary world with, you know, guns and everything. Overall, when I first saw the zombies, I was like, oh no, it's another zombie story, but you had a really good spin on it. I really liked the idea of these things appearing in the mines, and you did a kind of a unique take having them take place, you know, around the Civil War. I also had a few problems with attribution, not knowing who's talking and when, but that's easy to clean up in the next draft. That's about it. Thank you so much. I really, really enjoy this, and I know the next draft is going to be even better. So thanks, and goodbye, everyone. Bye.
Cheaters. Cheaters. No, we'll have to explain that. First, this is WBAI New York. The program is Hour of the Wolf. What you have been listening to is an edited down version of about 50 minutes, 45 or 50 minutes of critiques of the story number 35. Now, what happened after that is that the author, Devin Poor, gets to respond and talk to the group. Now, if you want to hear the complete critiques and what ensued afterward, you can do that.
Hilarity.
Yes, yes, hilarity ensued. And you can go to ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF/ AF, yeah. For altered fluid. And there you get the whole nine yards. You get the photographs and everybody and the follow-up. But we're going to have sort of a follow-up here right now, and it's a unique occasion. Something I've always actually wanted to do was come back and revisit stories. And actually, we should do another show in which everybody who's read, which is like, you know, seven or eight of you at this point, and say what happened to the stories after they were read on this show. It would be very interesting to see. But we have that opportunity right now, since that took place on September 27th.
Wow, that long ago.
Yeah, that long ago. I was astonished.
I should be done editing this by then. No?
Yeah. So, well, not necessarily.
I was writing a novel. That's my excuse.
I should have been editing the crits. I did it all today and built that web page today. So why don't you tell us, and this is all at your own, some of your reactions to some of the crits, and B, how did you change the story so far as a result?
First off, I'd like to say excellent job on editing that down. You seem to hit all the high points. And one thing that, if people listen to the full critique, they will get this, but you didn't because you edited that part out. A lot of times whenever you get critiques from multiple people, they start hitting on the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
And you know that's an issue with the story that you need to take a closer look at.
Yeah, and I really did, people miss that nuance. But, yeah, whenever there was redundancy, I got rid of it. Mm-hmm.
And so on that, the things that that I've basically been focusing on in the story are those things. The character of the priest has... was one of the things that kept coming up. And the reason that I have so much trouble dealing with him is the story started out as like this three or four paragraph experiment I wrote a year or so ago, and it's the first two pages of the story. So anything that has to do with him is really hard to deal with because, you know, that's the genesis of the story, and I don't want to, you know, change it that much. But it's come to the point now where I'm pretty much decided that I might completely get rid of that character, or I might have him be a person that lives in the town, actually. And Chris, of course, wants him to be eaten by something, because that's Chris.
You gotta sacrifice someone.
That's Chris's solution to. And the other thing,
both Chris and Matt, by the way, said in the critiques they want blood.
Yes, and one of the things that I've dealt with in that respect is, and also with fleshing out the town, is, you know, I deal with there's more people visible in town. These are things that I add normally, as because this was a first draft. I don't do outlines. My first draft is my outline, and then I flesh it out in subsequent edits. And so what I've been doing is I've been putting in more people, and so you get to see the body count. And I think one of Chris's recommendations was to make the monsters more menacing and reduce their number, which I've done. I've cut them almost in half. And I've made it so that they are much, much more difficult to kill. And I made
the half that eats, presumably.
Yes.
The top half.
The top.
Yes, the top half. And I've made, because one of the things that always bothers me about Westerns is how everybody is a Clint Eastwood-like shot, which I really don't like, and I didn't realize I'd done this in this story until I started reading it again. And so now Nathan's a much worse shot. He actually uses he goes old school Clint Eastwood a couple times and whips out the shotgun in order to get the job done. Let me see. The biggest thing, though, that I wanted to deal with, and did you leave that? I didn't hear Tempest's crit, where she wanted to know exactly what the story was about. Like the theme
no,
of it.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't leave it.
Okay.
The part where she didn't get the meta.
Yeah, which is the biggest thing that's bothered me about this, because I normally don't write action adventure-y type stories, and it really bothered me that that's what I considered this to be, and so that's the biggest focus I've had on this, and what's been the biggest hang-up, why I'm not done with the critiques yet. And I actually worked on this past weekend where I could not go any further with editing the story because I didn't know what to do with it. So I just sat down and did a free-form writing exercise in the main character's head about his thoughts on the war and about his brother's death and everything, and about it. Basically, it's boiling down now to about how he feels that the government basically through his brothers, bought lives away. And now he's starting to see that with the miners in the mine. And so I'm trying to draw some parallels with that. And the only problem with that, though, is it's going to, if he gets all self-righteous and anti-government and anti-mine at the end, then the ending has to change.
Yeah, the con markedly. Job ending would be, yeah, would the, be kind the, of weird with that.
Yeah, him going along with the con job at the end is not going to resonate at exactly. all. So I'm still...
I mean, I like the con job thing, but like I said in my crit, like there's it bifurcated the story in this strange way, and the mm-hmm. direction that you seem to be going in would not lend itself to that. It would lend itself to something more serious. And yeah. Like,
you know. Well, it would just have to be a lot darker humor.
Yeah, and like whatever their role is, I mean, they could still be conning him, but I don't know if like his reaction to it would be, and now
yeah,
I'm going to be
that's,
in on it, you know?
That's the thing. That's, mm-hmm. you know, his reaction whenever he finds out he's been being played at the end is not going to be, oh, sure, I'll join you now. It's going to be more like a bullet between the eyes.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Blood.
It would make a satisfying ending.
Well, we want more Carrie so that she can be killed.
Human shield.
And one thing that kept coming up a lot that I still don't know the answer to, and it really doesn't bother me that much, is people trying to figure out if these are vampires or zombies, and I really don't...
They're thingies.
Make them,
they're
door number three, is yeah, what I exactly. think. Like, make yeah. it... Give them a characteristic that is so emphatically neither of those.
Well, that's kind of what I started doing. Whenever I was home over Christmas, I watched at my parents' house, because you watch a lot of TV when you're in the middle of Indiana and it's cold out. National Geographic specials on caves where they have all these weird creatures that have evolved away the need for eyes and everything. So,
well, like I always wondered what was down there that made them that way.
Yeah.
Well, like that Stephen King, was it Desperation or the other one that went along with Desperation?
They're giant mining mutant and they find something eyeless down salamanders.
There. I forgot about that.
Did anyone
they touch
something like that? Yeah.
The movie The Descent. I mean, like there were like creepy killer. Cave creature things and that too. I mean, like they weren't classified. They were just creepy killer.
I don't think
cave
you necessarily
creatures.
Have to name yeah. what they yeah. are. You
I mean, I think
that there's.
I don't think I have to either. But it seems that people really
the
want
trouble
that.
Is that.
No, I
that
just want to know why
they started.
The way that you described okay. it, I think, is hitting on people's trope buttons.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And so the trouble
true.
Isn't that like we have to know what they are. It's that you just the way you describe them. It's like you. They're so close to the tropish description of a vampire or a zombie mm-hmm. that you like. It's like I kept like running against it and thinking, well, which one are they? And then I picked okay. zombie mm-hmm. basically. But I think and that's why if you yeah. give them something that is emphatically neither of those,
okay.
it'll and, make people be able to leave the tropes alone.
And okay. I think in the first draft, I think you had that scene where they kept coming out and they just kept killing them and they were yeah. like piling up into this stack and that made them seem like. Zombie kind of creatures.
Yeah, like not
okay, yeah.
scary.
Disposable,
if you've
easy
changed
to kill.
Them mm-hmm. and made them more,
yeah.
you know, aggressive or dangerous, then I think that addresses
yeah, much
like
harder
lizard
to
eyes. I'm just like yeah. something that just yeah. doesn't
really
it doesn't
weird.
Square with the other things.
Or like
yeah.
a weird color, or like yeah, I mean. Anyway.
One of the things that didn't make it into the final reel on what I was talking about was that in terms of the mathematics of what's going on. What I thought is they should kill all of them. Like, all of them should be present and accounted for in the body count, but whatever the creature was that was the tipping point should still be down there.
Yeah.
And that he should be sort of sitting there in the dark saying, yeah, we killed all of them, and he's kind of counting in his head, and then he says, but, you know, we never did address what it was that started this thing in motion, and then he hears something in the dark and realizes he's alone in the dark. That moment in the mine when he's alone in the mine and he hears something... I think needs is a great moment, and I think we need more of it. And I think more of you. The whole story has taken us to this point, right,
mm-hmm.
where he's helpless in the dark. So let's.
And then we have a horror-filled ending where yeah. he turns into an evil creature, and Chris has now taken the story to its darkest possible point.
How far did I have to go? He's alone in the mine with his hands bound behind him.
At least she didn't kill any babies this time.
No.
Bury them in the garden.
Okay, I want to go on record as saying, Raj said that about me. I've never said that.
Two words. Radio drama.
Radio drama.
Yeah, especially when you're dealing with the stuff in the dark and all that.
Mm-hmm.
It is the impact.
You can do all kinds of echo effects and everything.
Oh,
and water dripping.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm up for working on that.
Yeah. You have a better radio voice than I do. I can't keep my throat. Oh, and the one thing that you brought up about Miss Summers.
Yes, I purposely stayed away from mentioning that because Buffy. I was, well, you know, let's face it, the Slayer is Miss Summers. Yeah.
That's one of my drawbacks. I've actually never seen an episode of Buffy, so.
Yeah.
And when you were reading it aloud, for some reason, my head spelled it as S-O-M-E-R-S.
Me too.
Like, although I read it, but I still... Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's your accent.
Yeah, my accent. And the fact that I lost my voice about halfway through the reading, too.
Now, we can take phone calls for about 10 minutes, if you like. The point is, everybody calling must be relevant. Yes. Not relevant, you get... We're gonna have to have, like, the official Monroe-Littman hang-up. Now that Monroe is dead... I don't have anybody to say stay on topic Monroe anymore.
You should do the gladiator, like thumbs up or thumbs down.
Yes, exactly.
Actually, that it was opposite.
It's a throat cut, actually, in old time radio. It's a throat cut, just a finger slashing across the throat. And therefore, for that reason, because I may very well be playing short shrift with calls. We'll have plenty of time for general calls next week. But this week, be relevant or be gone. 212-209-2900 is the number to call to speak with. In the studio, we should mention everybody's name. Devin Poor, Rajan Khanna, Matt Kressel, Alia Don Johnson, and Chris Dykeman are the people in the studio. Obviously, there are more people in Altered Fluid who are all on the tape and can also be heard in their entirety, in all their glory, at ourwolf.com/AF. Good morning. You are on the radio.
Good morning, and I will be brief. Devin, Poor, can I ask several factual questions about the story?
Yes.
This is a post-Civil War American frontier. Is it an altered reality, or is it our old West?
I never really consider that type of stuff whenever I write it. I consider it to be both.
Like, I will say one thing. There weren't that many evil creatures like that during the Civil War that I'm aware of. Ken Burns skipped that whole thing.
Yeah, well, you made reference very, very quickly to vampire hunting in Europe. That's what I was wondering about. So obviously, this priest or whatever he is, and his group have gone hunting vampires in Europe.
Mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily want to convey that they had been hunting in Europe, but, you know, in our times, late 18th century, early 19th century, vampire lore was common.
The other question is, these creatures, whoever they are, vampires, zombies, mutants, giant turtles, whatever.
Thingies.
Thingies. Did they get that way because of something ecological down there?
That's Chris's question, and she keeps bringing up, and I'm still working. Yes, they did. Basically, it's an instance where the mining company dug too deep and...
Yeah, because that's appeared in a number of things.
Silurians.
Animation things that I've seen, you know, Mutant Ninja Turtles and Justice League. Anyway, my last question. Is there some sort of conflict between the mining and... Because you mentioned oil. Or didn't I hear that?
No, that's at the end of the character, like the tertiary character that comes in at the very end.
Oh, I see. So 35, the guy who escaped, he's a friend of the narrator.
No, he was just one of the miners.
Well, he was just one of the
miners. He was the sole survivor of the miners.
Thanks a lot. Good luck with the story, and I hope you really... I like the setting. I really do. A post-Civil War West with alien creatures. I love it.
Thank you.
Okay. There was a movie like that, I think. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, turn down your radio.
Yeah, let me turn that. Sorry. Yeah, okay. How you doing? Good morning to your guests. Just wanted to comment. I kind of like the story. I like some of the holes in it, too. It left a lot to the imagination. Even though I know, like, where the creatures came from or how they evolved, I didn't find that too necessary for me to know. I like the fact that you left some openings in it, and I just think it should be, as far as more detail with the characters. Was it like kind of like a treatment or a script, or is it actually going to be a short story?
It's a short story. As I don't know if you heard one in the comments, a lot of people outline before they write a short story or a novel or something like that, and I can't work that way. I've tried, God knows. But my first draft is kind of an outline, so it's basically a treatment that's going to be modified and edited into the short story.
Oh, I see. Yeah, but I think you should keep some of the mystery with it as far as where the creatures come from or how they proceed. Do you have like a serial format in mind with these three characters being the main protagonist?
Not specifically, no. I usually write stories in threes, so this is my second story that's set in post-Civil War West. I'll probably write another one, but it's kind of like the old Clint Eastwood movies where they consider it like a trilogy, but they're not really related at all.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I think it would be something to explore with those three characters. They're kind of intriguing if you sketched them out more and gave them more of a backstory.
Mm-hmm.
But all in all, good work, good work.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Great call. Take care. 212-209-2900. We had a couple of other calls, but they have a tendency to drift off. Ooh, that was a good call, though. I really liked what he had to say. And personally, I also, I have to ask this to the group. I wonder if the sheer fact that it is a writer's group, that people have to turn in a critique. Is it possible that there are too many gaps to be filled in? This gentleman, he liked the gaps. He didn't want backstory everywhere. He liked to fill it in himself using the mind's eye. Is it possible that sometimes coming up with something to say could... could change it, sort of a Heisenberg principle.
Everyone has a different voice, I think. You know, and you your critique, you have to tailor it to their voice. And I think, you know, you see a couple stories from a particular member in the group, and you say, okay, this is what particular elements I feel, you know, they need to work on. Some people's, you know, I remember I used to write stories. And I say, isn't it patently obvious what I'm talking about? And Chris Dyke can be like, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, I was way too subtle. And then some people were like, you know, Mr. Exposition here. And he walks in the room and says, here's what's going on. So, you know, it really depends on the individual.
In any critique, you learn very quickly that if you answer everybody's question, you will turn every short story into a novel. So, I mean, you have to pick.
Right. And it becomes a style issue to a point. I mean, I personally don't like everything when I read to be spelled out. Like, I like a little bit of mystery, and I like, then that's okay to me. And then there are other people who read stuff, and they want to know the background, everything to be spelled out and logical, and you know, it's just, it you can't please everyone, mm-hmm. so you just have to kind of write what you write and hope that the right people will find it.
And on that, you just have to, you know, after a time, you figure out, it's like, I think I describe Carrie Summers in this. I give like a physical description of her, but I hardly ever do that because I want, you know, the reader to fill in, you know, what the character looks like in their mind, because that's the type of story I like to read.
That's the mind's eye and the power of the mind's eye. Mm-hmm. An interesting thing that Matt brought up, he said, you know, that it's often tailored to the person writing the story, cut out from Eugene's crit, which is on the website, is he specifically cites, he said, this is like something else that you've written, Devin, I know your voice and all that. And that's exactly right, that this isn't just people who come together, read a story, and then immediately critique it the way that our phone callers had to do, but these are people who all know each other for years and work together,
right?
And learn each other.
I think it's not necessarily taking the story and saying, okay, how would I make this better, but how can I make this person make the story better? Do you see what I'm saying? Because everyone would write the story in a different way. You have to say, how can I help this person to make the story best for the way they're trying to tell it?
Yeah. Like in this case, a lot of people had an issue with the character of the priest and what he was and wasn't doing. And all the suggestions or all the critiques brought that up, but then nobody specifically said, I think he should do this or I think he should do that. But it calls your attention that that's something that I need to look at and resolve it in my own way.
Yeah, so it brought up a sore point without actually
Yeah.
And whatever that may be. So we may be losing the priest, or we may be giving him a totally different...
Yeah.
A kind of... One person, was it Greer, I think, who may have said something like that, either lose it or use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something along those lines. But again, let me urge everybody, go to the website. one person got that reference too. Go to the website and listen to the entire session, because it really is illuminating. It's not just that we're having fun and giving you a story here. What we're also trying to do is clue you, the listener, into what goes into the craft. What is the art? What are the mechanics? What is the craft of writing fiction? And I think by listening to the entire crit session and the resulting discussion immediately after, which is about 10 minutes of, and by the way, some of it's very funny, you will, I think, understand something more, and possibly, by the way, may even want to form your own writers groups or... seek one out. I know that a lot of people who listen to this show are inclined to be writers, and therefore, personally, I find this fascinating. One thing we did 15 years ago, Carol Emschwiller came on the show over a period of 6 months and read 3 versions of a story. She read her first version, then she read it to her class. And she changed it for the class, knowing there was a totally different audience. And she was trying to do it as a teaching exercise. And they gave her comments, so she wrote it a third time. So we actually had 3 different iterations of that story. And she's a wonderful writing teacher. Mm-hmm. So that was a very instructive kind of thing. And I think that we're getting that here tonight as well. For those people who want to learn that and, of course, know more about altered fluid, ourwolf.com/AF, as in altered fluid. Speaking of altered fluid, not March, but April at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, 2 members of altered fluid with new novels out for Eugene Myers, his first novel, yay, fair coin, and for Alaya, your umpteenth.
My fifth?
Your fifth novel, jeez.
I don't know. It's something like that. fourth or fifth.
And what's the title of that novel?
Wicked City, being the sequel to Moonshine.
Yay. Are you gonna have another...
We're going to have another ridiculous throwdown. I'm turning 30 on the 31st, so planning to have a party for my birthday and my book.
And everybody's invited.
So, you know, all the cities invited
New York.
Can I do the music again?
Oh, definitely.
I have lots new 20s and 30s music. A lot new flapper music since the
last
time.
So we get to dress up again?
If you want to.
You need to do that again.
I drag my dress out. Lord knows.
I'd like to make it this time.
Are you going to have my wife dance in a bikini again?
Banana bikini.
The venue I have
with
is
bananas.
Slightly smaller, but yes. Yes, Devin's wife put on an amazing Josephine Baker banana dance, complete with a banana grass skirt that Devin made for her to a live Dixieland jazz band. One of the more amazing things to ever happen in a book party.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and there are great pictures from that thing. I have some of them up on my Picasso website. And the movie of the dance, by the way, is also available there. Mm-hmm. Well, we are about out of time. Last words, anybody? Does anybody have anything imminent coming out to discuss? I'm sure, well, we mentioned Eugene. Oh, Saladin Ahmed. He'll be on the show in March.
Well, David's not on the show, but Mercury Rivera just sold the story to Asimov.
Yeah. He's skyrocketing. He's getting to be another Nora, isn't he?
Yes.
All these awards and all that.
Mm-hmm. His huge
Locus Awards. Yeah.
Did we figure out that he's the only one who sold his Hour of the Wolf story?
He is.
That is correct.
Yeah. I think really?
Yes.
Yeah. And boy, I've had listeners call up and say, where can I get that story, the one that had the Earth with the pin going through the middle of the magnetic.
That was brilliant.
Did you sell it? It was Interzone. Yeah, it was one of the mini Interzone Mercury Rivera stories.
I think he's on the masthead of Interzone by this point.
Well, I want to thank you all for being here. It's been too long since we've done this, but it's difficult conforming to the new format. I think we have something here on how to do it, though.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it's worked really well. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, and what we're going to do is we're going to keep that webpage up, including with this show, and keep that online so people can hear that crit, and hopefully we'll have the follow-up story when it's done. And so people can hear them overall. Sure. Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Next week, I won't be on from 1:30 to 3. I'll be on from midnight to 3 with, believe it or not, the 40th anniversary of this radio program. God help me. Thank you all. Elias wasn't even born for 10 years of this. I don't want to deal with it. Okay, thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister, who's still got some clothes on. I'm amazed. Okay, take care and have a good morning.
Colors are awesome. Dude.
Belfast, and forget Korea, Lincoln, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, Lincoln, talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central, L.A., California, I.A., Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, Lincoln, yeah. My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why the wanna stole me when I tossed the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
List alive right here at 7 minutes after 3 o'clock. Here we go. Burn the American flag to ashes with no apology. OWS, overthrow Wall Street. Hey, 99 Sinker List alive. Don't do it. Clappers, y'all. Oh. Now you know why Pacifica Radio had to put this show on at 3 o'clock in the morning. Because we mean what we do, y'all. Do it. Hey. 99 Sinker, tell a friend, burn, baby, burn, y'all. Accra, Ghana, OWS, Accra, Ghana, 25th of December, You're bound to remember Accra grammar, Accra, Ghana. On the 25th of January, OWS takes over. Y'all occupy Ghana. We say OWS overthrow Wall Street. Yes, sire. OWS Nigeria. Burn, baby, burn style. Take it to the hills. OWS Ken Sawawiwa style. Overthrow Wall Street. Occupy JA Yard style.
We gonna pull some air. Won't you move your hands into the air? We gonna shout. Ain't gonna stand down. Gonna pull some air. Come on, raise your voices so they hear. We gonna shout. Scream it out clear. Gonna pull some air. Come on, raise your hands into the air. Give me the feeling that you're keeping the faith. We gonna pull some air. Come on, raise your voices so they hear. We gonna shout. Scream it out clear. I never did no harm, mister. No.
Give it to me two times. You give it to me three times. You give it to me four times. 54, 46 was my number. Was my number, man. Right now, someone else has that number. 54, 46 was my number. Right now, someone else has that number.
I'm not a fool to hurt myself.